So
now we move on to this we have done the verse of Mahapajapati and Sundari Nanda, her daughter, and the next one is Subha. Subha, she was the daughter of a goldsmith and called Subha, which means beautiful, because she was beautiful. As a young adult, she became a follower of the Buddha after seeing him at Rajgir. She became a stream winner, a stream enterer, as a layperson, simply after hearing the Buddha teach. And then she was ordained by Mahaprajapati. And although happy and virtuous as a nun, her relatives continually tried to entice her back to lay life. So she was diligent in her practice, and she soon gained liberation. Now, this is a long one. Sorry about that, but I will read it out. So this is where she is explaining about her background and her accomplishments. I first heard the Buddha's Dharma when I was still young. It was on a day when I was wearing clean clothes, and by my own effort, there was comprehension of the Four Noble Truths. Right then, I found that I had a great dislike for all that my senses find pleasing. I was afraid of my own body, and I longed for freedom from it all. I left my relatives, slaves and workers, the rich villages and their fields, everything pleasing and delightful. I left more than a little wealth. I went forth. I went forward with my faith just like that, into the Dharma that has been so well taught. So it is not right for me now, when I desire nothing at all, to come back again to the silver and gold I have thrown away. Silver and gold don't lead to awakening and peace. They are not fit for an ascetic. They are a wealth that is not noble. Wealth comes from greediness, makes your head spin. It deludes and increases defilements. It brings many sorrows and is dangerous. There is nothing you can count on in wealth. Men get excited near wealth, and they get careless too. Their minds become dirty, and wealth makes them ever at odds with each other, and they endlessly fight among themselves. Death and bondage, calamity and robbery, grief and lamentation. There are so many miseries for those who get caught among what pleases the senses. My relatives, you know that I have gone forth, that I have seen what is fearful in what pleases the senses. So why are you trying to get me back to those pleasures as if you were my enemies? Gold and money do not lessen the depravities that ooze from within. Urges that come from our senses are enemies, butchers, foes that bind us with ropes. My relatives, you know that I have gone forth, that my head is shaven and I wear a nun's robe. So why are you trying to get me back to those pleasures as if you were my enemies? Picking up as alms what others discard and wearing rags as a robe, that is what suits me. It is all that is needed for someone homeless. Great sages have given up all pleasures of the senses, divine and human pleasures. They are free in the place of peace. They have attained constant happiness. Let me not even find something that pleases the senses. No place of safety exists amongst them. They are enemies, butchers. The sufferings they bring do what large fires do. Greed is dangerous, fearful, destructive. It has thorns. It is so very wrong, harmful too. It makes one stupid. The urges that come from the senses are trouble. They are frightening like a snake's head. Yet ordinary people, always blind, ever fools, are still delighted by them. Many people in the world are really fools. Because of the mud of what pleases the senses, they have no idea where the bounds of birth and death are. On account of the urges of the senses, humans happily follow the road to lives of misery in the lower realms. They bring sickness on themselves. That's how the urges of the senses give us enemies. They are burning and defiling the bait in the snare of the world, fetters, shackles to our actions. The urges of the senses are maddening, enticing. They trouble the mind. They are a net laid out as a trap by Mara to defile beings. The urges of the senses are endless dangers. They bring many kinds of suffering and are a great poison. They give little satisfaction and instead bring grief. They dry up the good opportunities that come. On account of the urges of the senses, I have ruined so much. I will not go back to that again. Now I will always take my delight in nirvana. Longing to become cool, I did battle with the urges of the senses. I lived diligent while the shackles of those urges pass away. I will go on that path by which the great sages have reached nirvana. It is griefless, faultless, full of peace, straight, the Noble Eightfold Path. So then, spoken by the Buddha to pray Subha. Look at Subha, the goldsmith's daughter. She has become calm. She meditates at the foot of a tree. Today is the eighth day since she went forth, faithful. She is beautiful because she has realized Dharma. Taught by Upalavana, she knows the triple knowledge and she has left death behind. Subha is a slave who has been freed. She now has no debt. A nun who knows how to know well, free from everything that held her back. She has done what needs to be done and is free from the depravities that ooze from within. Those who compiled the text said, Indra, Lord of gods, of all beings, used his power to come with a host of gods, and he worships Subha, the goldsmith's daughter. So, as I mentioned before, we have to, the two main themes running through these stories are about total renunciation and the recognition that that which is served to the world as desirable is deeply undesirable. So I think the point of this is the Buddha himself said that anyone practicing the Dharma is like a fish swimming upstream when the rest of the shoal is swimming downstream. And Atisha, Paladin Atisha, the great Bengali scholar, said that the supreme conduct is to be out of harmony with all the world. We imagine that as nice, good little Buddhists, we have to be in harmony. No. Inwardly, it doesn't mean we quarrel with all our neighbors, but it means inwardly we are not in harmony with the values that is put to us by society. That we see through that and that we are going in the opposite direction. So, right from the beginning, it was understood that our minds are very much disturbed by the input coming in through our sense doors. That's, of course, the eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, nice sights, lovely sounds, beautiful smells, nice things to taste, and pleasant things to feel on our skin are desirable, and the reverse is undesirable. This is how we are programmed. So the problem is not whether things are desirable or undesirable from the point of view of our egoistic conceptual thinking, but how we respond to those things. So it's not really so much that you all have to now immediately renounce everything and go forth barefooted, but that we should keep a watch on how we respond to our sense stimuli. Apparently, everything which we receive through our sense doors, including the mind door, our conscious conceptual thinking mind, we automatically respond with a like-dislike reflex. Normally, the stimuli is not that strong, so it just slides off again. Or we don't notice it because we are being bombarded by so much stimuli. But apparently, every single stimuli, it has this pleasure-pain response inside. So the problem comes that we see something that we like, and then our mind reaches out to grasp it. Or something which we do not like, which our mind then automatically reaches out to push away. In other words, we feel pleasure we like, or displeasure, and we feel irritation, annoyance, and so forth. And then there is a third response, which is a kind of neutral indifference, which is linked to our inherent delusory, ignorant mind. It's a kind of non-reaction, but not an awake non-reaction, but a kind of dull non-reaction. So the problem, therefore, is not the external objects, no matter how she's putting it, but it's not really, the problem is not the external objects or the sense door which picks up those objects. The problem is the mind, what it does once it has connected with that consciousness. So as you know, there are six basic consciousnesses, five sense doors, and the mind consciousness. Now, whatever that receives, the point is, what do we do with it then? And what normally people do, who are not being mindful, like all you lot, ordinary, unmindful people, they grasp at what is pleasurable and they reject what is unpleasurable. And then that keeps us endlessly churning, endlessly turning. Really, it cannot be stressed enough. Any of you who have done retreats, which I'm sure almost all of you have done, you notice that. How reactive our mind is, unless we are genuinely mindful. So in those days, especially, it was regarded as the easiest way to undercut the whole craving scenario, especially craving, was to just renounce it all. The Buddha said that the cause of dukkha is our underlying craving. Anger is not such a problem. Many times, east or west, when I go somewhere, I give a talk, one question always comes up: how do I deal with anger? People always want to know how to eradicate anger because anger feels uncomfortable. We don't like being angry. It's not a happy state of mind, and people don't like us either. And so if people who have a rather angry temperament are always happy to find some solution to that and to eradicate their anger. But the Buddha said, as I'm sure you know, that even though anger is karmically much more heavy because it's destructive and negative, nonetheless, craving, it's relatively easy to get rid of anger, the Buddha said. But craving is very difficult to uproot. When I was living in Lahul, in my cave, outside the cave, say I'm the cave here, me, I'm the cave, right? And then right here, this was like a kind of patio, like flat land. And then it went down towards where I had a little garden and then straight down to the valley. So this part here was beaten earth, which was fine, except that when it rained or if the snow melted in the spring, it all became mud. It was all thick mud. So I thought, okay, I need to lay down some flagstones so that, you know, I'm not embedded in all this mud. So I gathered a lot of big flat stones, but on this surface, this baked earth surface, there were little bunches of, from here and then there and then there, these little bunches of pretty little pink flowers. They were very sweet, little pink flowers with little yellow centers, all in a cluster, one there, one there, one there. So I thought, well, I can't put the flagstone straight onto these clusters of flowers because it will be uneven and wobble. So I will pull up these little clusters. So I went to pick one up and the cluster, and it wouldn't come. I thought, oh, these roots, they're quite deep. So eventually I got a kind of pickaxe and I started digging down. And in the end, I dug up the whole of the surface because underneath were these thick, thick, like the root system interconnecting all along and underneath. Some of the roots were this thick. And deep, 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 all the way down. And the only visible sign were these little clusters of innocent little pink flowers. And I thought, this is like greed and craving in the mind. Looks so innocent. Pretty even, charming. But the roots in our psyche are so deep and thick and almost impossible to eradicate. And yet that is what's keeping us in samsara. That is what is causing the wheel to keep going round and round and round. But it looks harmless. So, the solution was to completely dig him up from the very roots. And so the way they did it was through total renunciation, seeing danger in even the smallest perk of any kind of desire or greed or craving. We think some craving's okay and others is not so okay. Yeah. I mean, a little chocolate, a little ice cream, something nice to wear on special occasions. In itself, the problem isn't the object. Objects are innocent. The problem is our response to those objects and the mind which reaches out and wants to grasp and hold on. And so this is why these nuns were so totally one-pointed. Absolutely nothing which stirs our greed was to be allowed. The answer to all this was that they got, I mean, she became an arahat in 8 days. The Buddha just said it, right? An arahat is someone who has totally eradicated all the negative emotions, all the afflictive emotions of our greed and anger, jealousy, pride, because we have seen through the fiction of the ego. So therefore, an arahat walks the world egolessly. So, in the time of the Buddha, many, many people were becoming arahats. And again, we have to ask ourselves why. At that time, so many people could attain nirvana with relatively little difficulty. And nobody quite knows why. But there's so much. It pervades the whole canon. So it can't just be made up. I think maybe one of the reasons was because they met with the Buddha himself, which must have been an extraordinary experience. Imagine meeting with the Buddha. And the karma that one must have created to have the causes and conditions to meet with the Buddha doesn't just happen like that. There must have been extraordinary reasons from the past lives to have the karma to meet actually with the Buddha and hear his teaching. And this had such a strong effect on people that, as it says here, she immediately went into stream entry on hearing the Buddha preach. And so she had already made that first initial breakthrough. She had already glimpsed nirvana. She couldn't remain in nirvana at that particular point. The ego took over again. But nonetheless, she had already made that big breakthrough, the first one. And then that gave her the courage and strength and conviction that she had. That was all that mattered. Nothing else mattered. She had seen nirvana face to face. What else could matter compared with nirvana? What does samsara have to offer compared with that? So her family trying to get her back. Oh, you can live nice and comfortably in the house and still practice. Don't worry, don't worry. No way. Nothing is going to stand in the way of my vision of where I have to go and what I have to do in this lifetime. So this is why these nuns, so many of them, they just went straight for the goal. They were not distracted by anything. No excuses. Just straight ahead. Nothing, Nothing could hold them. And so they attained. We make all sorts of excuses. We procrastinate. We dawdle around. And then wonder why we're not arhat. Well. So the point is that these women, having the deep conviction of where they needed to go, what they needed to do, nothing else held any attraction for them. It almost wasn't even renunciation. Because renunciation means you're giving up something you want. And they didn't want anything. Sometimes I compare it to, like, if you're a child, a small child is very attached, say, to their teddy bear. And they love their teddy bear. Even if it's only got one eye, they love it. It's my teddy. And if you took the teddy bear away from that child saying it's worthless, don't look, I'll give you something so much more exciting than the dirty old teddy bear, it will hurt the child. Because the child is so attached to their teddy. But as we grow older, then we are no longer attached. We are no longer interested in teddy bears. We are interested in other things. And so of ourselves, we put aside the teddy. Because our interest is elsewhere now. And so it's like that. If we see something of so much greater value, then our interest in other trivial things declines. Or like you could say, the leaves in the tree, if we try to pull them off in the summer, there's resistance because the leaves are still very attached to the tree. But come the autumn, come the fall, then the leaves fall off by themselves. They're no longer attached. So it's like that. It's not that it was any pain for them to leave the homely life. Something so much greater was pulling them. And that's what they were reaching out for. Their desire for liberation overcame completely their desires for worldly pleasures. That's why they were full of joy. They're not sitting in the corner crying about it. They gave up something which inherently is not worth holding on to for something which is eternal, deathless. Liberation. So, although the language is quite strong, it nonetheless is pointing to a truth. They really had understood something so much more important, the most important thing in all the world. So it's driven by this fear of endlessly being reborn and redying and reborning and redying, endlessly being recycled. I mean, that might be ecologically very sound, but it's very tiring to be endlessly recycled. And they wanted to break out of that into a whole different realm of deep wisdom and compassion, which was nirvana. So compared with nirvana, what's samsara got? This is why they could let it go, even while they were young. Nothing that the senses had to offer. Oh, it's so gross compared with the subtlety of realization. Yes? So again, with the next one, it's saying more or less the same thing. This is Sangha, she's called. I gave up my house and set forth into homelessness. I gave up my child, my cattle, and all that I loved. I gave up desire and hate. My ignorance was thrown out. I pulled out craving along with its root. Now I am quenched and still. So that sums up the attitude. She gave up everything, her family, her home, her wealth, her affluence. But along with that, she also gave up greed, anger, and delusion. And specifically, she pulled out craving along with its root, because it's not enough just to pull out craving if we don't pull out the root. It will just grow up again. So we have to go deep into its root. And the root, of course, is our ego-grasping mind. When the ego dissolves, there is no more grasping. So therefore, having pulled out this craving with its root, I am now quenched and still. Okay, so then we move on to a whole other subject, which is for a reason why women entered the order. These were first were women who had everything from outwardly, they were affluent, they had loving families, they had all the pleasures of worldly life, but they renounced it because they saw something beyond that. Often because of their meeting with the Buddha, they were deeply inspired to give up everything, let everything else drop, and go forth with faith from home to homelessness. Now we are coming to these women who were driven into the order by great grief. Many people come to a spiritual path through suffering, having encountered suffering and needing a refuge. People look for spiritual answers. And especially Buddhism is therefore quite popular insofar as it talks a lot about suffering. It doesn't say that all life is you know, joy and light and love. It looks at our worldly life with very clear eyes and says, there's a problem here, but don't worry. I mean, the Buddha himself, the supreme physician, said, you're sick. We're all sick. This is the cause of the sickness. Good news, we are inherently healthy, and here's the remedy. So, therefore, a lot of people come to the Buddha Dharma, even at the time of the Buddha, knowing that psychically, psychologically, they were very sick. And this was usually on account of external conditions, which are sometimes very severe. As in the case of our next lady, Patachara, who really, if you think you have problems, just read her and then you'll feel much better. Many examples of women who lost their children. Now as then, the most important role a woman could hold is as the mother of sons. There is a saying in India, may your wife have a son and your cow have a daughter. Because, of course, male cows are pretty useless. You want a female cow so she will, in time, you know, give milk. But for a woman, the main point, even now today in India, is that she should be the mother of sons. Because a daughter is not very useful. Even today, in Indian society, and now it's worse actually, especially for the middle class, because if you have daughters, you have to, of course, you bring them up and you love them, but you have to educate them highly, and then you have to essentially pay somebody to take them. So you're not selling your daughter. You have to give a dowry in order for people to take your daughter from you. After you've brought her up and educated her and taken care of her and trained her, then you have to pay somebody to take her. So, of course, and then she belongs to her husband's family. Whereas your son will marry, bring the wife's dowry into the family, and your daughter-in-law will take care of you. She will be your slave, just as your daughter is somebody else's slave. So, of course, people don't want daughters. In addition, when the father of the family dies, it's the son who needs to light the funeral pyre in order that the father can be reborn in heaven. So if there's no son, they're in trouble, even today. So therefore, in many households, a daughter, and especially many daughters, is considered a disaster. It's very expensive, and you don't get anything from it. Even our maintenance manager, his wife had two daughters, no sons. And when the daughters were young, he had their hair very short like a boy, and they were dressed in trousers and a T-shirt. So they looked like boys. And I think it was because he didn't want to admit he only had girls. I mean, now they're lovely daughters, and I mean, he adores them, and they're beautiful. But still, you know, if people say, how about sons? You know, he feels very ashamed to admit he didn't have any sons. And in time, he's saving up now so that after his daughters are educated, he can give them a dowry so they can marry. Many girls in India, up to the present day, women, are killed by their in-laws because they didn't bring enough dowry. They pour kerosene on them or petrol and set them alight. This is very common. So for a woman not to have to be married and not produce a son is considered a great disaster, and often she has a lot of trouble with her in-laws as a result of this, and her husband. So now is then the most important role a woman could hold is as a mother of sons. A woman's position in her husband's family depends a lot on this, and she can be replaced by another wife if she does not produce at least one son. I mean, certainly one of our ladies who work for us, she is the second wife of the husband because the first wife didn't have children or she didn't have a son, and so he married again somebody else, and they all live together. I mean, it's okay. But, I mean, sometimes they even take a third wife. I mean, because always infertility is blamed on the woman. So therefore, if the first two wives don't have a child, then he'll keep going until he finds somebody somewhere who will produce, or else he gets too old and gives up. So through the death of a son child, to lose the death of the son to lose is the only hope. What? I don't know. I was thinking. To be respected and accepted by any by your husband's family, it's very important to have a son. And so, if you lose one, if the child dies, then it's really it's disastrous. Motherhood being worshipped as the ideal state, and fertility is very much revered, how many children you have, especially male children. And even in Buddhism, of course, the Buddha used the mother as the epitome of loving kindness and compassion, just as the mother loves her child, her only child. And in fact, if you look in the actual language, it says, as she loves her son, her only son. So, a woman was considered as being midway between birth as an animal or as a human male. I mean, she was below the male. In the Tibetan word for a woman is kimen, which means inferior birth. So automatically, if you are born as a female, you are inferior, even in Tibetan tradition. And in fact, some monks one time asked me, that, in a very kind way, that they were speculating among the monks what I could have done wrong in my last lifetime to have been reborn as a female, this one. And I said, you don't think it could be going upwards? They looked at me like I was nuts. So. Okay. But as a result, I mean, in many Buddhist countries, women pray, and including nuns, they have prayers to be reborn as a male next time. One of the reasons, of course, is that as a female, you had so much less opportunity. You were so less free. And as for nuns, they were not usually educated or really nurtured on the spiritual path very often. And they were also, kept under control. So therefore, they look at the men, and the men look so much more free, and they have all the opportunities. And so naturally, you want to get reborn as a male. Okay, so Patachara was born to a wealthy banker's family in Shravasti. Shravasti, the Jeta Grove in Shravasti, was the Buddha's favorite place, if we're allowed to say that he had favorite places. He spent 25 rainy seasons there, out of 45. So he loved, and at certain times he also praised Shravasti for its beauty. It's a lovely place, well, it used to be. I don't know. Anyway, so she was born to a wealthy banker's family in Shravasti. The family arranged for her to marry a man of equal rank, but she had a lover among her servants, and so eloped with him and settled in a remote place. After some months, she became pregnant and wanted to return home for the birth. This, you remember that at the time of the Buddha, Mahamaya also was returning to her own home to give birth, but she got caught midway and therefore gave birth in the grove at Lumbini. But she was actually going back to her parental home. This seems to have been the custom. So Patachara, she wanted to return home. Her husband was very reluctant, naturally, and procrastinated. So Patachara left him, and then because she was so late in her pregnancy, she gave birth midway to Shravasti. So then she returned home again with her husband. For her second pregnancy, again the husband was reluctant to let her go home. She left, however, taking her first child with her. The husband followed, and then as they were going along, they met with this huge big storm. So they needed some shelter, and the husband goes off to cut grass to make a hut. But meanwhile, while he's cutting the grass, he's bitten by a snake, and he dies. So she doesn't know what's happened, and thinking herself abandoned, Patachara gives birth and lies on top of her children to shelter them from the storm. In the morning, she discovers her husband's body, and so for 2 days she's in great grief because now she has these two little children, her husband's just died. Then she starts again towards her parents' home. The river is now very swollen with flood water. She is too weak to carry both children, so she takes the newborn first. She takes the child first, the baby. On the far shore, she places her baby on a pile of leaves and keeps looking back as she recrosses the river. Halfway across, she sees a big hawk seize the newborn baby. She screams, and the older child thinks she's calling him. He thinks his mother is calling him, so he comes down to the riverbank, falls in, and drowns. Right? So now she's lost her husband and both her children. In utter despair, Patachara continues her journey to the outskirts of Shravasti. She meets a townsman and asks about her family. He tells her that their house collapsed in the night due to the heavy rain and killed everyone, the banker, the wife, and the son. So at this point, she's lost her whole family, she's lost her children, she's lost her husband. So Patachara goes out of her mind and wanders around aimlessly. In time, her clothes become ragged and fall off. Townspeople drive her away with sticks and stones and rubbish. Still mad, she one day arrives at the Jeta Grove outside Shravasti, where the Buddha is teaching. People try to drive her away, but the Buddha puts himself in her path and says, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." So Patachara instantly recovers and sees she's naked. A man throws her his outer robe, Patachara means a cloak wearer, and she asks the Buddha for help and tells him her story. The Buddha says that in many lives you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the four oceans. Her grief grows less heavy. The Buddha further explains that when she herself dies, no kin can help her. Even in this world, no family can really help. Then Patachara asked to be ordained, and she was taken to the community of nuns. One day, while meditating, she saw water trickling over dried land, some being absorbed quickly, some a little longer, and some after that. The same with humans. Each has a different length of life. Some die early, some die in maturity, some die when they're very old. One night, she entered her room, and as she was extinguishing her lamp, it gave her the insight to be free. Later, Patacharya was one of the most beloved and important of the bhikshunis and attained as an arahat. So then these are her verses. Furrowing fields with plows, sowing seeds in the ground, taking care of wives and children, young men find wealth. So why have I not experienced freedom? When I am virtuous and do what the teacher taught, when I am not lazy and I am calm. While washing my feet, I made the water useful in another way by concentrating on it, moving from higher ground down. Then I held back my mind, as one would do with a thoroughbred horse, and I took a lamp and went into the hut. First, I looked at the bed. Then I sat on the couch. I used a needle to pull down the lamp's wick. Just as the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So then, Patacharya's words to a group of nuns, again. Young men find wealth taking sticks and threshing grain, taking care of wives and children. Do what the Buddha taught. There's nothing to be sorry for after doing it. Quick, wash the feet, sit down off to one side, intent on calming the mind. Do what the Buddha taught. And then spoken by Patacharya's students about themselves. They heard her words, what Patachara taught. They washed their feet, sat down off to one side, intent on calming the mind, they did what the Buddha taught. In the first watch of the night, they remembered their previous lives. In the middle watch, they cleansed the eye that sees the invisible. That means watching the coming into being and deceasing of all the beings in the universe, the divine eye. In the last watch of the night, they split open the mass of mental darkness. In other words, they realize nirvana. Standing up, they worshiped Pattacharya's feet and they said, "Your advice has been done. We will live honoring you like the 30 deities honoring Indra, who is unconquered by others in battle. We know the three things that most don't know, and nothing fouls our hearts." So Pattacharya became very well known as a teacher and had many students, many disciples who themselves attained to liberation. So therefore, the cause of her suffering, this losing, so everybody that she loved and everybody that she held dear, which in itself was such a tragedy that it drove her to become completely crazy, was also, in fact, the cause for her to go forth and attain to liberation. So had she not had that, I mean, it's not that we therefore think you should go around killing off all your family to. But had she not gone through all that suffering and had just led a contented family life, she would never have met with the Buddha and gone forth. So again, this illustrates for us that sometimes the things we go through, which we think are the worst things that could happen to us, often could turn out to maybe be the best. We are only judging by the point of view of our own ego, which is always grasping at what is pleasurable and rejecting what is not pleasurable. But that is only the ego's view. If we could see the vast panorama, then we would recognize that many of the things which at the time seemed the most difficult, in the end, became our greatest opportunities. So we will leave it there now, because the next one is Kisa Gotami, who is very famous, of course. Our nuns are recently at a picnic. Our nuns, our middle nuns and small nuns, they like to put on plays, little playlets which they write themselves and perform. A favorite one is the Buddha coming down from heaven after teaching Dharma to his mother. They like playing the Buddha. They're very interesting because, you know, on the one hand, they're nuns. And at the picnics, then all the lamas and the big professors, the kempos and people come. And their teachers who had taught them before come. And so they're performing in front of all these monks. And they love to play Rinpoches and kempos and that sort of swagger and climbing up on the throne and all the other nuns prostrating and, you know, giving a Dharma discourse. And, of course, the monks, the lamas are all, you know, falling over themselves. They just think it's hilariously funny. But they really can parody these lamas. You know, they're not afraid. And right in front of them, you know, they do it. Anyway, one of the plays they put on was about Kisa Gotami. Because she is also well known in Tibetan circles, her story. So we'll do with that tomorrow. And at 4:00, then we'll have questions and answers. So as I explained before, what? Yeah, they're outside. A little piece of paper, please. You don't ask to. I have 5. Questions, 1, 2, 3, all written in very small letters, you know, on both sides. No. Please just keep to just one question, 2 at the most, and short and sweet, indeed, so that we can get through as many questions as possible. Okay, if you have any. If you don't have any questions, it's wonderful. We'll just sit and meditate.
I can take the microphone. And now the group practice discussion starts. So please have a look at the lists outside if it's your turn. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.